I'm going to talk about considerations in format. First, one must determine the purpose of a public speaking event or a debate. Is it primarily educational? Is it done for competitive reasons? Is it an investigation on an important public affairs issue, for example, the interview of a politician or other government official on a television program? This is essential to the foundation for skill development. It's actually the format that might trigger the development of some skills relative to other skills in an event. And so to determine the purpose of the event is an important one. Let me contrast American and British parliamentary debate as an example. In American parliamentary debate, there are two teams involved in the debate, one on each side of a motion. In British parliamentary debate, there are four teams involved in a debate, two on each side of the motion. In both cases, they are two-person teams. In American debating, everyone delivers a speech, but one person on each team delivers a second, a rebuttal speech. In British debating, everyone delivers a single speech. What does this mean in practice? Well, in practice, it means that in American parliamentary debating, there's more emphasis on content. And the reason for that is that there is that second speech, a rebuttal speech, that summarizes all the issues that are involved in the debate, but directs attention to an initial case and its counter from the other side. In British debating, there's an opening proposition team and a second proposition team. The second proposition team offers a variation of the case that's originally presented. This means that there's less attention drawn to any specific issue in the debate, but there are other skills that are developed in British parliamentary debate. For example, if you're one voice among eight, you have to make a much more dynamic presentation in the debate. You have to be a better public speaker, you need to be more persuasive, you need to be more entertaining. In addition, points of information, parliamentary points in which you are able to interrupt the presentation from an opposing side to ask a question or make a statement, points of information are much more powerful devices, because you have no other opportunity to express your point of view in the debate. You get your speech, and then you get points of information. In American debating, you get a rebuttal speech to also allow your side to make arguments in the debate. And so these interactive and dynamic elements that develop the skills associated with the manner of presentation, the style of presentation, are slightly emphasized in the British format, where content and depth of analysis on an issue are slightly emphasized in the American format. That's not to say that one can avoid style in an American parliamentary debate or content in a British format debate. Obviously, content and manner matter in both of them. But it really is a question about the emphasis of each, and those skills are developed based on the format choices associated with American and British parliamentary debate. In addition to determining the purpose of your event and what skills you're trying to promote or what purpose you might have beyond the development of skills, for example, to inform a public audience, there are practical issues associated with the selection of a format. First, judging. In the British format that I just described, a parliamentary debate, there are eight debaters in a single debate. Although one might receive more than one judge to evaluate the performances in that debate, there's no requirement for more than a single judge. In American format debating, you need one judge. Although you might get more than one judge, you require one judge for every four debaters. There are forms of debate, however, Lincoln-Douglas debating in the United States, debates that is one-on-one debating, where you need one judge for every two debaters. This might present a difficulty. In practical terms, one needs judges to evaluate debates, and if you have a limited judging pool, it is better to use formats that are judge-friendly. You need to have many competitors with single judges or panels of judges, rather than few competitors with single judges or panels of judges. You also need to consider the event duration, the time for speeches and number of debates. If you're going to have a public debate, you might only need an hour. If you're going to have debates in the afternoon or in the evening, you might need 3 hours to have a couple of debates where students could debate each side of a motion, or or an affirmative side and negative side of a policy question. But if you have tournament debating in which you involve hundreds of teams from around a country or across the world, you might need 3, 4, 5 days for a competition for that many participants. And so event duration is important to consider, the amount of time that one would need for a single event and how many consecutive events one would hold during a particular event. Finally, you need to consider speaking time for an individual. Now, let me just mention that I think it's important in public events and sometimes in competitive events to include the voice of the audience. This is particularly important for educational or investigatory events that involve the public. As much audience input as possible improves the quality of the performances of the debaters, as well as gives voice to people when they really need it. And so it might be necessary to include speaking time for the audience in a public debate, perhaps speaking time of 30 to 45 minutes on an important question of public affairs, floor speeches in a competitive debate, allowing 10, 15, 20 minutes for floor speeches during a debate is also appropriate. But if you're going to have individual speeches, no more than 6 to 10 minutes are required for any individual speaker, unless they are the sole speakers in the debate and it is a public debate and you want to inform the public about an issue. You might want to give speakers 20 minutes apiece before you involve the audience or you have interaction with each other. The issue of speaking time involves skill development of the speaker, how long must they speak to work on the skills that are appropriate for the event, and how much you want to inform the audience, educate them about a particular issue. And those vary from context to context.
My specialist subject, my field of expertise and enjoyment is that of parliamentary debating, and I want to spend a few minutes just talking about the different styles of parliamentary debating, where they happen in the world, the number of people who are involved, a brief discussion of the differences between formats and that kind of thing. First of all, I want to talk about a competition called the World Schools Debating Championship. In the past couple of years, this has been held in Pittsburgh in 1999, in London in 1998, and in previous years in places like Bermuda and Israel and Canada. World Schools involves high school students who are under the age of 18, who are not yet at an institution of higher education, and takes place in teams of 3 students versus 3 students who will all speak for 8 minutes. The typical parliamentary time signals will be given. You'll hear a knock of the gavel or a strike on a surface after the first minute. You'll hear a similar strike after the 7th minute, and then a double strike after the 8th minute. The strike at the 1st minute and at the 7th minute mark the start of something called unprotected time, during which your opposition speakers, the team on the other side, may rise and make a point of information, which is usually either a question or a statement of fact that is designed to confuse or interrupt the speech of the opposition. The 3 speakers, after they have spoken, will be followed by a summary speaker. One of the 3 will opt to summate the case. Topics are typically on international issues or broad principles such as euthanasia, abortion, juvenile crime and delinquency, those kind of things, and are evidential but still audience-centered. The type of motions and the preparation involved divide into short preparation motions and long preparation motions. Short preparation motions usually involve about an hour before the motion, before you're due to debate, the motion is announced, and you go away and research in your teams a case to present. And long preparation motions are announced considerable time before the actual tournament itself. This allows in-depth cases to be constructed, perhaps in the manner of policy debating in the United States, or Karl Popper debating, or styles such as NPDA, where one would pre-prepare a case and then run a case in that way. Judges are typically teachers or educators, and the focus, as I've already said, is very much one of evidence-based argumentation, but very much as well centering on the audience. Now, the second type of debate that I want to talk about today is that of British parliamentary or world-style debate, and I'll refer to it as world-style debate from now onwards. This is a format that is used at the World Universities Debating Championships, which in previous years has been held in Sydney, in Manila, in South Africa, in Greece, and in Ireland. This format will involve four speakers on either side, and they will be divided into two teams of two. The motion will be announced 15 to 20 minutes before the debate actually takes place, and speeches are usually of 5 minutes or 7 minutes in length. The protected time and unprotected time issue again exists in the university style of debating, this parliamentary style of debating for universities as opposed to the schools one, and that is signalled after the first minute, after the fourth minute, and a double strike after the fifth minute, or obviously in the case of 7 minute debates, then 1, 6, and 7. Again, crucially, points of information are essential. They demonstrate that you are an active part of the debate after you have finished speaking. They allow you to interrupt the flow of your opposition speaker. And indeed, as with world schools, whilst you're making a point of information, your timing will continue. The other crucial issue about parliamentary style at university level is the issue of the case extension. After the first two teams have spoken, i.e. the first speaker for the first team for the proposition and the first team for the opposition, the second teams have a burden to extend the case, to make the case more interesting, not more interesting, to allow more issues to be discussed in a more, perhaps a different perspective or from different principles, that kind of thing. They're very rarely an additional policy that will be added, but they usually present their issues as an alternative view of the motion, alternative motivations for using it. So, for example, if your first case had outlined moral, social, and economic reasons why one should take action, the second team may advocate that there are compelling political reasons, or perhaps that there are compelling reasons why, if we do not take this, bad things will happen. So, in short, parliamentary debating at the World Schools Debating Championship and British parliamentary style or world style very much focus on the audience. They're very evidential, but they require slightly different skills to those of American style debating. It is crucial to evaluate the perspective of your judge in a way that perhaps in America that does not happen so much. Those things having been said, parliamentary debating is a very enjoyable format to adopt and is very amenable to public discourse and public debates, and those will be talked about at a later point.
I'm going to introduce you to how policy debating is done in the United States, give you a little history of it, and try to explain the process. Policy debate in the United States occurred since the middle of the 19th century. In its present format, it really appeared in the middle of the 20th century. What ended up happening was, at the beginning of the 20th century, colleges and universities, mostly, and some high schools in the United States, developed debaters and debating teams. And how they would debate is they would go to another location and debate against another college or university. An illustration, there's some records that we have at the University of South Carolina, which talk about early debates in the 20th century where South Carolina would travel to the campus, for example, of Davidson, and there South Carolina would debate Davidson, and they would have one debate, and South Carolina would travel back to Columbia, and maybe on a subsequent weekend or two or three weekends later, Davidson might come to the South Carolina campus, debate one-on-one, and then go home as well. What happened is, after the Depression and during World War II, colleges and universities realized that this was not the most cost-effective way to have debating clubs. And so the tournament was created. And what happens at the tournament is that there's a host site. And at the host site, colleges and universities from the region or even the entire United States will come together in order to debate against one another. So at any given tournament, you might have 10, 20, 30, 50, or even more colleges and universities competing on a given weekend in a tournament format. And the tournament format is pretty straightforward. You have a series of preliminary debate rounds where teams are debating on the affirmative or the negative, and they have a series of rounds. They win or lose those rounds based upon a decision reached by a critic. Those are tallied up. Those with the best win records would then proceed to an elimination round. And those elimination rounds look just like the single sudden death elimination brackets we associate with major tennis tournaments throughout the world. In other words, you may have 16 teams in the first elimination round, which we whittle down to 8, down to 4, and finally down to 2 for a final round to get a tournament champion. The next thing in the history of policy debate worth mentioning is how the plan happened. At the beginning of the 20th century, the debate resolutions were written in such a way that they tended to be pretty finite. In other words, they were very precisely written. They would be questions as to resolve that the United States should provide Marshall funds to Europe for its recovery. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's a pretty it's a simple statement. Also, it was during this period when the resolutions were looked at as hypotheses and were debated as such. So when someone was affirmative, they would be supporting the entire Marshall Plan. And they would be arguing that the entire Marshall Plan should be adopted and it would benefit all of Europe. This changed after a while, and the way it changed is twofold. The first thing that seemed to have happened is in the middle of the 20th century, people started introducing plans. And a plan looks a lot like a government bill, though it's much less wordy. It tends to be a summary of a bill. The reason the plan was first introduced is because it's a way of clarifying what the affirmative meant when they made their policy arguments. So when someone was arguing whether or not it was a good idea to have a Marshall Plan, instead of talking about it in a great broad sense, they might focus on specific elements of the Marshall Plan and its effect on specific countries. And the reason they would do that is a simple practicality and for simple clarity purposes. At that point, plans became more and more popular because they made the debates much clearer. In turn, they also tended to turn debates into something that was much more inductive, because debate teams who were affirming would be talking about precise parts of government policy and claiming if these precise parts of government policy are a good idea, then the government policy is a good idea as well. Debate sort of changed after a while because policy debate took a less view of the debate resolution as a holistic entity and started looking at plans as ways affirmatives could define what the resolution meant. Hence, anything that was outside of what the affirmative defined the resolution to mean might be not germane. And so plans became incredibly popular, especially going into the 50s and 60s. As such, topics were written to accommodate the plans. The topics were written much more broadly so there could be more plans within the topic area. We debate resolutions like the United States should adopt a comprehensive program of national health insurance, incredibly broad debate resolution, and designed in such a way so that plans could be extruded from it. The more current debate resolutions has often provided lists of countries or lists of policies for lists of countries. And those debate resolutions are designed in such a way as to make plans pretty easy to defend. Debate tournaments, however, are not all similar. There are four-person team debate tournaments, which still occur mostly at the secondary school level. In other words, you might have a four-person team where two members debate the affirmative and two members debate the negative against other schools. So whenever school A is debating school B, there'll be two people who'll be on the affirmative, and if school A is going negative, it'll be the two other people who will actually be in that debate. And so there are four-person team debates. The most popular one are two-person switch side debates, where each team has two people on it, and in one round they'll go affirmative, and another round they'll go negative, and there's a balance that tries to take place at tournaments where if someone is affirmative in the first round, then they'll probably be negative in the second round. If they're negative in the third round, they'll be affirmative in the fourth round. There tries to be a balance on the number of times they're affirmative and the number of times they're negative for reasons of equity. There's also tournaments that are Lincoln-Douglas type of debate tournaments. They're not like the Lincoln-Douglas debates historically, but they are one-on-one debates. where the affirmative is one person going into the round, and the negative will be represented by one person in the debate, and they would just speak against one another. There are a whole series of other variations on that, but these tend to be the three predominant. Policy debating in the United States tends to be associated with high schools, colleges, and universities. They fund these programs. They're either club organizations or official functions of a high school, college, or university. A very new type of a policy debate entity was created over the last few years, and it's fondly referred to as cartel debating, where what ends up happening is you have a group of colleges and universities who league together as a cartel and debate as a cartel. The most famous one is the cartel in New York, which involves a series of 3 to 5 colleges and universities at any one time. Also, colleges and universities often use mixed teams. In other words, if one college has one debater that wants to debate but has no partner, they can often solicit another college or university to provide a partner, and that would give them a mixed team for a tournament. How about the formats for these debates? Well, most popular format in academic debate, and at least policy debate, deals with two-person switch side debating. There'll be 8 speeches and 4 cross-ex periods. As a rule, there will be 4 constructive speeches and 4 rebuttals. The constructive speeches are about twice as long as the rebuttals, even though that tends to change over time and sensibility. Right now in the United States, we generally have 9-minute constructive speeches and 6-minute rebuttal speeches. The affirmative speaks first and the affirmative speaks last. The first person to speak will be an affirmative constructive speaker. She will be cross-examined by a member of the negative team. Then we'll have a negative speech, which will be a constructive speech, followed by another cross-ex period by a member of the affirmative team. That'll be followed by an affirmative constructive speech, another cross-ex period, and a negative constructive speech, and another cross-ex period, at which point we'd go into the rebuttal period. The rebuttals start with the negative. So what we end up happening in the rebuttals is we have the speeches going negative, affirmative, negative, affirmative. There's no cross-ex period. We end up having in the middle of the debate something referred to as a negative block. There'll be a negative constructive speech, followed by that cross-ex period, followed by a negative rebuttal speech. In Lincoln-Douglas debating, even though it's one-on-one and you only have one person on the affirmative and one on the negative, the same process tends to work, where the affirmative will speak first and last, and in the middle of the debate will be a period of time where the negative will speak longer than the affirmative, and it's to compensate for the fact that the affirmative speaks first and last. Also in these debates, there's something called preparation time that is used. And preparation time is an allotted time that is given to each affirmative team and negative team, which they can use in any way they see fit. That preparation time usually ranges from 8 to 10 minutes, and it is used when no one is speaking, no cross-examination is taking place, and it is used by the team who is about to speak next. So if the affirmative constructive speaker gives a speech and there's a cross-ex period, and the negative speaker needs a few minutes to prepare, those few minutes are removed from their preparation time, and a preparation time is used quite strategically as well. What have we learned about policy debating? We've learned something about the history of it in the United States and how the plan occurred. We know that there are many different types of tournaments. Predominantly, there are two-person switch side and LD tournaments. Policy debating in the United States occurs in different flavors. There's quite variations in formats, but the predominant format in team policy debating is 8 speeches, 4 constructive speeches, 4 rebuttal speeches, with 4 cross-examination periods peppered within and after the constructive speeches, and they're all moderated by some preparation time. And that strange phenomenon right in the middle is often referred to as the negative block. I want to talk to you for a few moments about Lincoln-Douglas debating. The term Lincoln-Douglas debating obviously refers to debates that occurred in the United States in the middle of the 19th century between Abraham Lincoln and William Douglas. The problem is that that's where the similarity ends. Lincoln-Douglas debating generally refers to one-on-one debating that occurs in the United States. The debate resolution used in Lincoln-Douglas debating tend not to be policy resolutions. We might call them non-policy resolutions. They tend not to include the word should in the debate resolutions. They have different time limits, and there are different areas worth studying, and we'll examine a few today. First of all, let's talk about the speech order and the individual time limits associated with Lincoln-Douglas debate. And I'm just going to give you the ones that are popular on the high school and secondary school level in the United States, and they tend to be the ones that you see more often, even though there are Lincoln-Douglas debates now occurring on the college level as well. The debate usually starts with an affirmative constructive speech. It lasts 6 minutes, and during the speech, the affirmative debater will present a thesis and draw a conclusion claiming that the resolution being debated is true and does not present a plan like you would in a policy debate. That is followed by a 3-minute cross-examination of the affirmative speaker by the negative speaker, and then that negative speaker stands and delivers a negative constructive, which lasts 7 minutes long. So while the first speech is 6 minutes, which is an affirmative speech, the second speech is 7 minutes, and that is a negative speech. Usually during this speech, two things happen. The negative will argue against the affirmative case and present something called a negative case, which I'll get to in a few moments. Subsequent to the negative constructive speech, which lasts about 7 minutes, there'll be a cross-examination of the negative speaker by the affirmative speaker. And again, that lasts 3 minutes long. So at this point, we have a 6-minute constructive speech, a 3-minute rebuttal, a 7-minute negative constructive speech, and a 6-minute affirmative constructive speech, and a 3-minute cross-examination, a 7-minute negative constructive speech, and a 3-minute cross-examination. We now get into rebuttals, and in the rebuttals, the affirmative speaks next, and the affirmative speaks for 4 minutes, rebuts the negative case, and extends the affirmative case. That is followed by a 6-minute negative rebuttal. The negative at this point may either or go for the negative case and not attack the affirmative case in specificity, or attack the affirmative case and drop the negative case, or attack the affirmative case and extend the negative case. That is finally followed up with a second affirmative rebuttal of 3 minutes long. So the rebuttals are affirmative, negative, affirmative, 4-6-3. The format then is 6-3-7-3-4-6-3. 6-minute affirmative constructive, 3-minute cross X, 7-minute negative constructive, 3-minute cross X, 4-minute first affirmative rebuttal, 6-minute negative rebuttal, 3-minute second affirmative rebuttal. Affirmative speaks first, and affirmative speaks last, and if you add the numbers for the speeches, they all balance out. The topic areas choose for Lincoln-Douglas debate vary in many different ways. As I mentioned earlier, they tend to be non-policy resolutions. They don't use the word should in them in one way or another. For example, in the 1992-1993 National Forensic League Lincoln-Douglas series that occurred that year, the resolutions included the following. U.S. military interference in the internal affairs of other countries is justified. The next topic, in the criminal justice system, truth-seeking ought to take precedence over privileged communications. Next topic was, when in conflict, the spirit of the law ought to take priority over the letter of the law. And the final topic was, resolved, the principle of majority rule ought to be valued over the principle of minority rights. In Lincoln-Douglas debate in the United States, they have 4 debate topics, each lasting 2 months, with a 5th debate topic, which is selected for the months of May and June, and is normally associated with the national championships. In that year, in May or June of 1993, it was the resolution that protection of domestic order justifies curtailment of First Amendment rights. So as you can see, in these debate resolutions, we do not see the word should. We see quasi-policy or resolutions of value in fact, but not policy resolutions. And so we don't expect plans to be presented in the debate. That having been said, what are the conventions associated with Lincoln-Douglas debating in the United States? Well, the first convention is that the negative presents a negative case. In the constructive speech, that 7-minute speech that occurs, the negative presents a case against the resolution as a counterweight to the affirmative case for the resolution. It often provides quite a challenge to the critic in the debate, since the critic has to decide whether to believe the affirmative case or the negative case. And often, they almost have absolutely nothing to do with each other. One will say the resolution is true, and one will say the resolution is not true. And how it's going to be resolved in the debate round is left up to the critic. Most critics who are experienced learn that they defer to the better case. In other words, as a critic of argument, they would look to see whether the affirmative case makes more sense than the negative case, or if the negative case makes more sense than the affirmative case. Hence, incredibly subjective. The cross-examination is pretty challenging in a Lincoln-Douglas debate, and that's because without a teammate, you have to give a speech immediately after you cross-examine your opponent. So what ends up happening is that the affirmative gives a speech, and then the negative speaker stands up and cross-examines for 3 minutes, and then has to stand up and give a speech immediately. And so what ends up happening is this deferred format where the negative presents a pre-packaged case to whatever the affirmative is saying, and then talk specifically about the affirmative's arguments. When the negative case is completed, what the affirmative then has to do is stand up in the debate and ask a series of questions and then rebut what he or she just heard. The thing that's unique about Lincoln-Douglas debating is in the cross-examination period, because the questions tend to be very conditional and hypothetical. They're what-if questions. What they are trying to do in these debate rounds is Lincoln-Douglas debaters are trying to understand the depth of the arguments being presented in a debate by applying to the reasoning in the debate real-world observations. For example, if we were dealing with this resolution that occurred in May or June of 1993 that said the protection of domestic order justifies curtailment of First Amendment rights, the affirmative would have to make an argument about why the protection of domestic order is so important. And if that's the case, the negative may want to ask a whole series of questions that says, well, if, you know, the country's security is threatened, then does that justify protecting the domestic order? And the person might say yes. Because, well, if the person of the president is threatened, does that involve the protection of domestic order? And through the process of using a whole bunch of hypothetical or conditional questions, have a better understanding of where the break occurs in their arguments. In Lincoln-Douglas debating, then, it's an alternative to policy debating. It normally uses value and non-policy topics, distinctly different time limits. It does have the affirmative speaking first and last. There are certain conventions associated with it, normally the negative case, which is somewhat unique. And the cross-examination tends to be much more conditional and hypothetical than we find in policy debating. Thank you.
I'm here to discuss the issue of public debating. Let me first begin with the definition of what might constitute public debating as opposed to academic or competitive, more formal debating. Public debating tends to be non-competitive. It doesn't mean that there can't be an adjudication of a public debate, but in a general sense, it has a different purpose than a competitive debate, and so it tends to be structured as a non-competitive event. Its purpose is to educate or inform the public about a particular issue. It may also be designed to entertain an audience. It simply uses debate as the medium of exchanging ideas. Many people recognize that we have an insufficient or unsatisfactory amount of argument in the public sphere. We don't have enough public debate. We don't have enough public debating by political officials, by business leaders, by members of educational communities. And so public debating is a way in which we encourage participation and argument in the public sphere and try to do so using formal elements of debate, the fact that ideas are advanced and those same ideas are subject to disputation, to disagreement by another side, in order for an audience to both be educated, but to have them get the opportunity to engage their leaders about important issues to them. The format for public debate can be quite flexible. It can be designed for any context. It's not necessary for one to design a particular format and then impose that regardless of the audience or the space or the issue at hand. One should consider all of those factors in designing the appropriate format for a public event. Some of the events can be quite formal. One might have debate teams, individuals on each side of a formal motion with a specific speaker order and responsibilities for each of those speeches. One could determine whether or not other elements of parliamentary procedure, points of information or points of order, might be included in the debate. And one might also limit the interaction with the audience. In this kind of debate, a more formal public debate, there would actually be a debate on display for an audience. Presidential debates in the United States tend to follow that model. There have been some differences, but quite typically, the speakers interact with each other, or they present information to an audience or to a panel of journalists, but the general audience is not involved in feedback or questions or answers. One might also have an informal presentation for a public debate, an open panel discussion with moderated and constant interaction with an audience, or a question and answer session that follows the debate with an audience. I think in a general sense that the audience should be involved if it's practical. After all, the point of a public debate is to appeal to the audience, to inform and educate them, to entertain them in some respects. If the point of the event is to interact with the audience, it probably isn't a bad idea to include the voice of the audience and hear what they have to say about an issue. Where is it that public debates occur? Well, they occur everywhere. They're on college campuses. They happen before professional organizations, business delegations, community groups. They happen in front of city councils and school board meetings, with political campaigns, particularly on the local level. It is possible to design a public debate for any issue or any venue. The importance of public debating is that it's a way of connecting the academic world of debate with the community. I think that there's a special responsibility in this regard to use debate training that can be very sophisticated among debaters in practice around the world. They develop quite sophisticated skills. They are outstanding models of effective argument and persuasive delivery. There's a special responsibility to use that training to improve the quality of argument in the public sphere. In addition, everyone who's involved in debate are members of communities. They're members of families and businesses and schools, religious groups, social activist organizations, the military. There are all kinds of communities in which people take part. They should connect the ideas that are advanced in debate with those particular communities and the needs of those communities. People need to talk about public affairs and the way in which their lives are affected by the behavior of others, and public debating is an opportunity for it. It's a way in which academic debating might avoid ivory tower isolation or becoming only participating in a self-referential event in which debate becomes an end in itself. Here you can connect with a larger community and involve them in a world that matters to them. I'm here to discuss the issue of media debating, and media debating is a specialized form of public debating. Let me just mention quite briefly issues associated with public debating. Public debating tends to be non-competitive. Its purpose is primarily educational or informative. It doesn't mean that it can't entertain. It ought to still entertain. There are some advantages or distinctions associated with media debating as a form of public debating. It can be done over space and time. It can include written as well as oral information. This is particularly true for electronic and online submission of documentation, in addition to the elements associated with oral communication as part of the debate. And the debate, as I said, can be done in real time, or it could be subject to delay and might carry over a particular amount of time. The format for media debating, entirely flexible. It's possible to design it for the particular medium and for issues, audiences, and so one should be flexible about the nature of this particular format. It can be done in a formal way with teams following a set speaker order and limited interaction with an audience. It could also be done quite in an informal way, open panel discussions, many people involved in online discussions, moderated question and answer periods. And so I think that this is a wonderful format for experimentation, in particular because this is a new and burgeoning form of debate. That hasn't really been available in the past because of excessive costs associated with broadcast media and also the inability to connect in a convenient way with individuals when one was in a remote location. Could one have digital video and computer access while traveling? Well, these days, it's becoming increasingly less expensive and more available. And so it's possible to have these kinds of media-centered debates almost anywhere. And I guess that raises the issue, well, where can we hold these kinds of debates? Well, they can be held on the radio. There's no place necessarily associated with them as opposed to a virtual space available for them. They can be held on the radio. One could have television interviews, discussion panels on public affairs, or more formal debates. Certainly, internet streaming of events and video conferencing in which one or more parties engage in an open discussion or a debate. There are print opportunities through editorials and online journals and email discussion lists for serious debate. And I think there are some unique advantages associated with media debating. One is it connects the academic debate world with the world community. Here's the opportunity that one would have to engage in debate with people from all over the planet because costs are dramatically reduced. It's not necessary to travel to tournaments, although one might still do that. One could supplement that travel with online debate or broadcast debate. This improves international exchange. It means that we will end up with debate over space. I think this will improve the perspectives that people bring to debates. It will also allow us to discuss issues in real time with the people who are involved in world events and local events. In addition, one might be able to sustain participation in these kinds of debates for a long period of time. Most tournament debating and other forms of public debating are single events that last for an hour, and then everyone is dismissed from the contest, and the contest is over, and there is no follow-up. For online debating or broadcast debating, one has the opportunity to continue to engage in a discussion over a period of time, to have a debate that lasts as long as a war might last, or a hostage negotiation might last, or a conflict over the environment might last. And so one might be able to debate both over space and over time with this kind of media. And it's a wonderful opportunity to expand the possibilities associated with public debate.